Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation recorded live during the May 2022 Home Education Conference held in Orem, Utah.
My name's Stephanie Stander, and this session is called How Do I Unschool Math? Yeah, I am from Pocatello. My primary background is political science with some history and a dab of sociology thrown in there. But I've been homeschooling, I guess if I add up, it's more than 10 years because Gracie's 17. So I've been homeschooling about 12 years, 12 going on 13 years. Unschooling was not how I planned to start all of this. So it's been a bit of a journey that way. And I guess I started to feel a little more comfortable with it after coming to my first LDSHE conference and talking to a homeschool family that was graduating a young lady and talking to her and realizing how well-spoken she was and how well-educated she was. And so we kind of fell into it more by my children's desire, I think, than my really wanting to become an unschooler or fairly relaxed, but it's worked really well. So anyway, and if we have time, I can tell you kind of how we go about a lot of it, because we don't, I'm probably a little more controlling than what somebody would call a radical unschooler, because I do ask them to, you know, at least dabble in each major area each year. But my kids decided that it's boring to do the same subjects for very long, so we usually do about a monthly rotation on our subjects as well. So we have kind of our own take on it, but if that gives you an idea about us. Basically, what I wanted to talk to you about today, though, is that you really can unschool for math. We usually come into, what do we say about unschooling usually? What's the homeschool mantra for it? Well, you can unschool everything, but you have to throw a little math in there, right? You have to throw in a math curriculum, but you can unschool. So, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. One of the resources that I looked at, if you're interested, it's, I believe it's a blog, and I've looked at some other things on it, but I cannot tell you details about it because it's been a while. But I went back and I looked, and lauragraceweldon.com, she did, I think it was in 2014, anyway, she did a three-part series on natural math and some of the research on how kids learn in a less structured, just with, and she uses the term applied math, the math we actually use every day to function in life. And so there's some really interesting research out there on that. One of the things that came up, there have been two separate studies by that point, and I didn't follow up on this part of it, but what she pointed out is there had been two separate studies where they had studied children who had been, or adults who had been unschooled as children, and they were dramatically more, I think it was almost twice as likely to work in STEM careers as what she called their schooled, what would you say, anyway, their peers that were typically schooled in math. So it was much more likely that they'd go into STEM careers and things like that. And this, and some of this is probably more, this is more radical than what I do, but there's a really interesting study. It's about 90 years old, but it was done by Louis Benazet. And he decided to go to, we'd call the lower income schools and schools that had a lot of immigrants. And he picked, I think, six different districts and picked one first grade classroom in each of them, and these kids did not do formal math. He taught, what was it, reading, reasoning, and what he called recitation, but his version of recitation was being able to speak the English language and actually discuss things. And when math came up naturally in something, you know, if something was talking about a half, they would discuss the concept, but they didn't actually sit down and teach math. Well, they went ahead and they did this up through the first half of sixth grade in these experimental classrooms. And then some of the superintendents jumped on them and said, no, we can't do this. We've got to start teaching these kids math. So these kids from the experimental classrooms had 6 months of math instruction. And then one of those experimental classrooms was actually the top in its entire district. And that went on. These kids had much higher scores than their kids, than their peers who had been studying math from the start. They also had much greater gains in writing and reading. They weren't intimidated. He said when he went into those experimental classrooms, those kids would happily talk about what they were reading. He said if he went into a classroom, even in a wealthier, more highly educated family's neighborhood, those kids would be embarrassed to admit they read. And so they saw a lot of differences. When they wrote, they actually saw much more advanced language used. And when teachers read them blind, they assumed that it was the wealthier neighborhoods that were producing, instead of immigrant children whose parents didn't speak English. And they were the ones using, you know, 4 or 5 syllable words in their writing. So it's a really interesting background on it, that there's some argument that unschooling math really does actually help. So as opposed to sitting down and using a curriculum. So I've done something of a combination, but we started out, and I guess this was my personal little rebellion, because I remember my first grade math teacher threatening to cut our fingers off if we counted on our fingers, and she was going to make finger stew. I still remember that in my 40s. Is that terrible? So my rebellion, when I was teaching my kids, I taught my kids to count and do math on their fingers. So that was my, you know what, I'm done with your attitudes on this, people. Your fingers are always with you, so I have no problems with it. You know, I can take, I know how many fingers I've got. I've got 10. So when I'm starting, it's one hand, you know, and if I take 2 away, then I can count up and get 8. You know, and so we use that a lot. We've done, I guess I've called it M&M math over the years. So we started out, and at one point I went and just bought a tube of the mini M&Ms. And I have, my oldest two are only 1.5 years apart. So I set them down each with a little plastic plate like this, and I just counted 20 M&Ms out. And then I had them divide them by color. And they helped count them out, and then we counted how many each color had. And we talked about the colors. And then, you know, when we got a little better at this, we added blue and red, or yellow and brown, or, you know, any combination of them. Or we'd add 3 when we got, you know, when we got more advanced in it. So there was a lot of things like that that we could do. And you can subtract with them, too. So, okay, you have 20 total. Take away the blue. Now how many do you, you know, how many blue did you have? So how many do you have left? And do. So my kids liked having manipulatives that they could eat afterwards. So, yeah. I'd let them have the rest of the package if they didn't eat any while we were practicing, so that we had constant numbers. But the things you do to get kids, if your kids don't like chocolate, Skittles or multicolored, things like that. If you don't want to do that, there's plenty of other manipulatives. There's pieces of fruit or whatever. I liked M&Ms because they're uniform size, many colors, and chocolate motivates my children quite well. So, so we went a lot of different directions with that, and you know, and then we were able to grow that, you know, not just using fingers, not just using M&Ms as manipulatives, whatever, and then finding other things, you know, whether we counted what was in the cart, things like that. So does that kind of give you an idea on the preschool, kindergarten, first grade level that we did with it? Okay, and then I kind of went beyond the basics. You can move up and you can do multiplication and division without it being a curriculum-based. Big one we did was skip counting. That got introduced, I think it was Mickey Mouse Clubhouse back at that point. Somebody talked about skip counting, and my kids asked about it. Okay, that's easy. So we're at the store, and you know how lovely kids are when there's a 30-minute line sometimes? So we would skip count. We would give each other 5. Skip count. 5, 10, 15, up to 100. The line was really long and they were really bored. Depending on the child, it went a lot higher than 100. But it was a great practice way, and it got that down in their heads. My middle one, actually, he learned the whole concept of multiplication when he got a little sister. He was 7 when Paige was born, and he wanted to make bottles so badly. So he had to be able to tell us the whole ratio of formula scoops to ounces of water before he was allowed to help make bottles. And then we threw in he had to be able to define the word tepid and things like that so that he could get the water in the bottle the right temperature. So, you know, just all these different little things that we kind of threw in that ended up being, so yeah, I still joke that Zach only learned to multiply because he wanted to make bottles for Paige. But he was so proud of himself when he could finally tell us how to make a bottle at any amount, and he started to get helping to make bottles instead of just helping feed her sometimes. So it was one of our fun ones, and it was something he was very excited about because he was big enough to do, you know, a big person thing. You know, another one, I guess we spent a lot of time, yeah, we lived a ways out of town my kids were in this stage, so we were about an hour from the store. So the whole family went. So I had bored kids in line usually on Saturdays at Walmart. So you can go count the magazines on the rack. So how many magazines were there? Well, how many different kinds of magazines are there? How many magazines do you think there are total on the rack? Learning not only multiplication, but estimation. So how many do we think there are total? And then you can go check your work. So, you know, if you're going to be there a long time, then you haven't, you know what I mean? You check it, but you haven't counted all the magazines. And comparing sizes, all these different things. But there's also, and I skipped this, sorry, there's all the things we learn in our daily life. Everything involves math when we're doing that. When kids are building a fort, they're figuring out how far and how many of this they need. They're figuring out all these little things. I actually wrote this down on the different ones. When you're keeping score in a game, all your movement, most play involves learning those math concepts, and that really is a good basis to knowing math as you do it. And dancing, even when it's just my five-year-old is more the jump around dance point, but she's learning spatial relations as she jumps around and dances. And when they get older and you do, you know, a lot of us in homeschool end up doing ballroom at some point, foxtrot, cha-cha. It's all counting. It's all about math. And choreographers have math notation systems, have notation systems for different steps, and that's all based in math. So there's all these things that integrate math in ways that we don't necessarily consider to be math when we think about it all the time. Let's see. Sorry, I lost my point, my place here. Legos were another one. I've seen that recommendation in a few places in the homeschool community. Legos are a great one for multiplication, division, things like that. Especially you always have a bunch of the eight brick, or what do they call them? The eight stud. I had to look up what those little bumps on the Lego were called to make the notes for this. So you have the ones that have eight studs. So you can teach your child that two fours make an eight. So four times two, and four twos, or eight ones. So and obviously you can move on beyond that to the bigger ones and figuring out on the little bottom plates and things and expand it. But Legos are a great visual illustration of math as you put that together and how that works. Yeah, Legos are one of those because every kid sits down and goes, oh, this one has this many, so I can put this and this. And, you know, sit down and play with Legos and then translate it into math for them and point out where it is math. Baking and cooking together. What do you do when you cook? Okay, probably more when you bake. If you're like me when you cook, I'm terrible at measuring when I cook. It's enough of this and enough of that, but especially the recipes I know. But when you bake, what are you doing? You're measuring, because baking has to be exact. So when you're making cookies. So you get the basic idea down. You get the idea of, you know, this is what this means. This is what this means. You know, this is what half is. How does it compare to this? And you can go across and go through it that way. But then, once they get that concept down, you can introduce so many others, whether you have it, whether you double it, triple it. Then when you have recipes that have eggs in it, that's kind of the other level of difficulty. Because if it has three eggs, you can't have the recipe. You have to third the recipe. So, you know, eggs are kind of the master's course in baking math, I would say, just because it really changes how you alter recipes when you're going down when they have eggs in them. You know, good conceptual things, that there are static concepts in that. You know, you can't ever use half of an egg unless you're using powdered eggs or something. But in general, having an egg just doesn't work. So I've worked a lot with, and these are just a few of the things we've done. There's been a ton others, but these were some of the highlights in earlier years just to learn math concepts. And we did use math workbooks, but I found my kids retained so much more when it was hands-on applied math, when it's things in life. One of the things we do is our kids wanted to participate in doing like stockings. We never made stockings from Santa, so the kids were kind of onto that one, being that something that mom and dad did from the start. And they got old enough, they wanted to participate and help buy things. So we started drawing names. We put all seven names in a hat or whatever mom has handy when we get around to it. And then we pull them out and everybody gets somebody else's name, whether it's a parent or a sibling. And in past years, I don't know if this is going to work with the rate of inflation we've had this year, but we've done $5. And they have they have to put in 12 to 16 items. So we have some discount stores. We have a store called Westwood Discount that has a lot of seconds and things. Anyway, they just get random stuff from all over. We just had a Big Deal Outlet open, and they have returns and things that, and overstocks and stuff. So a lot of times you can get multiple things for under a dollar. You know, something, Big Deal will have stuff for 10 or 15 cents. It's not unusual. Candy bars are like 30 cents, that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of options that they can add up to make it fun, but usually not completely overfill a stocking or a bag, whatever we do that year. The math part on it's great because they're sitting there and they're figuring out how much. Well, Westwood Discount, most of their stuff ends in a 9. It's 19 cents or it's 39 cents or 79 or something like that. And a lot of times they have buy one, get a similar item half off. And they're extremely generous on what qualifies for half off as far as a similar item. So that adds in, you know, that adds in, makes an algebraic equation out of it really when you're doing that, because you've got to, you know, put the one item over a 2 and divide it out and figure out what it is. So they go in that, and then especially depending on your state sales tax laws. In Idaho, we have tax on food, but a lot of states don't. So if you don't have tax on food and they put in candy, is it taxed? Is it not? Things like that. So it really adds all these dimensions. We've done a lot of things with that. You can do that for Easter baskets, have them fill each other's Easter baskets too, something like that, and use the stores that are around you and the budget that works for you. So my oldest two children, after they entered Mutual, and yes, I can still say Mutual, it was Mutual then, but when Gracie and Nathan started in Mutual, they suddenly developed a bit of an attitude about what we were having for dinner. This is boring. I don't want to eat this. And I lasted less than a month before I was completely done with the attitude around my house. And I said, fine, you don't like what we're having for dinner? Guess who gets to start cooking 2 days a week each? So so my husband and I sat down and we thought, you know what? They're going to be going to college in a few years. They're going to be broke college students. So let's give them a tight budget to work on. So they got $20 each paycheck. We get paid every other week. So they got they got $20 to buy the main ingredients for 2 meals a week. So $5 a meal that they had to do. I'd have to do $10 now with prices up, maybe even more than 10 now, but I also have kids that are bigger and have bigger appetites too. But and we had things like we'd buy one of those, 10-pound logs of hamburger and have it in 2-pound sections in the freezer. So they had milk to use. They had our basic pantry items. So they had that to augment whatever it was. But the other ingredients, they had to keep in that $5 to make the meal. Boy, did kids start complaining less about meals when they were cooking them. So so this was a little bit of adulting 101 and, you know, crossed over into multiple subjects. But not only were they budgeting it, they were having to measure for some recipes and things like that. And it's been a really good thing. They may not like cooking. Maybe I didn't introduce the cooking part under the best circumstances, but because mom was a little ticked at the time. And Zach was 9 at the time, and he got to, on activity night, on the night that the older kids are at the activity, he got to do that. He got to be the one that cooked with a lot of extra help. So, and sometimes they just did salads with the extra ingredients. But they learned, you know, what can I buy when the budget's tight? What can I, you know, and learn to cook those items or at least mix them. So my kids still love the things that we did for our M&M math back when they were little. And one day in one of our journeys down the rabbit hole of homeschooling, we discovered that the M&M company had published their ratios of colors. It's not just equal amounts. They actually decided that it was more pleasing and people liked eating them better if they were a certain percentage mix of colors. So I've got that in here, and it's 24% blue, 20% green, 16% orange, 14% yellow, 13% red, and 13% brown. I would say on algebra, we actually use it more than we realize, because you really do use a lot of that. You don't necessarily think put an X in this spot, but you do think of having that. And I think it's good to have some of that, because at some point you may need to communicate a math problem with variables. And that's one thing, some of the reading I did preparing for this, there's a math professor from Stanford, and he pointed out that we have this idea that math is has a static right answer on everything, and that's really not the norm when you come into math. So, especially higher level, but there's a lot of math that you encounter. So I think teaching it that way, and I don't know what your kids' long-term plans are. At this point, Gracie wants to become a speech pathologist. And when you're doing speech therapy, you have to test kids. She needs enough to be able to do the statistical reasoning to see what percentile that child falls in which areas, and do they qualify for services. So things like that. My second oldest wants to go into either robotics or straight engineering. So he'll actually need probably math that's a little beyond mom, because I didn't take calculus in high school. So at that point, dad is teaching math, because dad did all of that, and dad knows a lot more on it. And some of it you learn in the field that you're in. My husband is a medical technologist. They're the ones that run all the tests in the labs. So, I was trying to think of one that's a less uncomfortable subject, I guess, but they get sperm samples for like people that are having fertility tests, and they put a grid over it, and you count certain grids, and then you have an equation that you go through to figure out what the overall sperm count is, because otherwise, you know, we're talking in millions here, so that's why you count like six squares, and then that gives you an idea what it is, rather than, you know, they don't want to pay somebody to sit there at the microscope for 6 hours counting every. So, you know, he uses it practically. He uses it on different things for viral loads, but a lot of that was taught in his area. Then again, as a political scientist, I used math in undergrad and graduate classes. You figure out representation levels. And actually, that's a fun one that I was going to suggest for older kids. There's one this came up in my college math class of all things, but there was one of the early censuses, so I think early 1800s, they actually ended up with a problem. This would have been a little later, sorry, because it was after they'd limited the house number to 435. But they ended up with the math looking like they would need 436, because you take the U.S. population, you divide that out by 435, and that's approximately how many people you should have per representative, right? And they ended up with two states that looked like they needed, and that both looked like they needed that last representative when they did it. Well, how do you figure this out? So things like that. A gerrymandering question came up in, do we all know what gerrymandering is? Okay, gerrymandering, I'm going to put my political scientist hat on here for a minute because it is relevant, though. Gerrymandering comes from, there was a Senator Jerry, and they were drawing out the district lines, and he made one that looked like a salamander if you just put on some nails and some claws on it and things. And so it comes from that, because it was such a ridiculous looking thing, but we have loose enough laws that they can get away with even stupid things like that. Well, okay, some of you are probably not old enough to remember this, but Newt Gingrich ran with Contract for America in 1996. And they basically took over both houses of Congress. Or was that 98? Anyway, it was Clinton's midterm is when it happened. I do remember that. And it's not unusual for a president to lose at least one, to lose their party, to lose congressional or Senate seats, or both. But in this case, they had gone in, so it may have been 92 now as I think about it. Anyway, they went in, and when they redrew the district boundaries, it looked like, if you just looked at demographics, it looked like those districts would barely go Democrat. So the Democrats on the board they didn't do the math. Somebody on the Republican side had done the math. These went Republican by about 0.5%, because you can usually estimate that about 55% of whites will vote Republican, and about 45% of whites will vote Democrat, about 90% of blacks will vote Democrat, and about 10% of blacks will vote Republican. By that, just looking at it, your mind estimated and went, oh, that's going to be a Democratic district, and it wasn't. So there's things, you know, that's my own field. There's things that show you the importance of actually doing the math out. And I've also done research studies. So some of it depends on what your kids are going to want to do. But when I was reading like some of the Laura Grace Weldon, she pointed out a research project that had been done, and they had looked at these men that, I think there were some women, but it was mostly men that worked in this factory assembling wooden boxes and crates to pack things in. And they were able to even convert bases. Do you know what that means? Like base 10, base 2? Base 2 is like your on-off that you use on computers, so you only have 0 and 1. Base 10 is what we use that has 0 through 9. If you get into some of the more hairy college math classes, you'll go up to base 12, which, by the way, it's really annoying to multiply in from personal experience. But so you have things like that. And these people with very little education could do these conversions without anything on paper. And then there was a strike. I believe it was a strike. And so they brought the management people down and had them working. And these are people with at least bachelor's and some of them master's degrees. And, you know, so they couldn't do the math in their heads in it because they didn't work with it. They didn't work with this manipulation. So the point was in this study, they pointed out that it's not just book learning. It really is the application. These people could sit there and say, this is what I need, and this is how I do it, and these are the measurements. But the ones that were just working on book work all the time could not put it down. And people that use math on a daily basis, in some studies it said they 98%, when you're using mental math on a daily basis, you'll get 98% on average right. When they had those same people go and put it down on paper, they only got about 37% right. So there are some definite drawbacks to using symbols or representation like we do on paper, because your brain actually knows how to do it. So yes, we have instances where you need to be able to show that to somebody else. You know, all sorts of reasons. If the bank makes an error, you need to be able to show the bank where the error is, right? So there's things like that. If your kids want to go to college, they've got to be able to do the SAT or ACT and get into college. So that's kind of where I'm at with my oldest, is we're transferring to saying, no, I know you can do this in your head, but they need to be able to see. You know, you need to be able to check your work sometimes and things like that, and double check where you got your numbers. And there are some cases you're going to have to show your work. You're going to have to show your work when you're testing a kid and prove to the insurance company or the parents where the qualification is. So does that make sense? Let's see. A fun one we had, and I was going to do this on a whiteboard, but we don't have them. So what's everybody's birthdays? This makes for a fun one. Mine's March 1st. So we took that, and we have birthdays across 5 months. My birthday's March, my husband's October, and we have one in March and one October. And then we also have February, August, and September. Who am I missing? Anyway, we have August, September, October, and then February and March. So it made for kind of a split. Well, we decided there had been something about it was going to be the equinox or the solstice on the evening news, and the kids were asking about that. And we decided, you know what, let's figure out who has the most hours of daylight on their birthday versus to who has the least, you know, and put them down. We threw in mom and dad's anniversary in May to give us another point of data. But if we're looking at this, so anyway, we can look at it. We've got, what, three of us in March, a February, two in November, a July, and an August. So who do you think is going to have the most daylight on their birthday? I'd say the July, right? So you can just go through and look at it with estimation. Well, then we sat down and did the numbers really closely. And Nathan's born on Halloween, October 31st. And TJ's right before Valentine's Day on February 11th. Well, we were thinking that, you know, end of October is going to be our shortest one. That was our estimation. And when we did the numbers, and we used constants, even though the equinox and the solstice move a little by year, we used March 20th, June 21st, September 21st, and December 21st. And we gave constants just so that the math was quicker and a little more, which it wouldn't be a constant because it's going to be a little different every year. Like I said, that not all math, you know, math doesn't have a solid answer in a lot of cases. And this one wouldn't, because it could differ by year. But we came to the realization that TJ's birthday on February 11th and Nathan's birthday on October 31st were equidistant from the solstice. Or maybe it was a day off, but it was close enough. It was like, whoa, that isn't how I... And so then we talked about why we had that bias. Why were we thinking that? And we decided it was because the days are getting longer when we're in February. They're getting shorter in October. So we're thinking that as being least daylight. but they were closer than we realized. So just random things like that. And you can go get, you know, extended family to do some, you know, go take your extended family and figure things like that out. And just, you know, that was kind of a random one we came across that was really fun, actually. And, you know, gave us a whole other thing in discussing our bias in surveys. In when we go into statistics, that we have to account for our natural bias of what things might be. Crafting has been a great one. My daughter has learned to love to crochet. My son knits a little bit, but my daughter has done afghans and things, and she's in all these Facebook crochet groups and sees all these neat things. She taught herself geometry proofs for that to figure out distance, and she said she's still trying to figure out how to estimate on yarn, simply because skeins are so many different sizes and tension and hook size, so there's a lot of things on that, but she figured out what the area is going to be and how she needs to do it to make it, okay, how big do I need this to be to make it a usable afghan? Well, my cousin Jaren's 6'8", so if I'm making it for Jaren, it needs to be this much bigger versus she's 5'7", so she's making it for herself, and mom aspires to 5'4" over here, so, you know, so she was figuring out all these different things, and she made, actually for Christmas, she made Zach an octagonal afghan. It's kind of a crazy looking thing, but she sat down and did the math to figure out how big this octagon needed to be. So, and I was going, I think I would need a lot of paper to actually do that. And she did the whole thing in her head. And I'm just going, okay, I'm not worried about geometry now. So, other than being able to put it on paper a little better. But, you know, if you do this, if you do, whether you call it natural math, unschooling math, whatever, if you do it, your approach is not going to look like mine has with my kids. We've tried this. Some of them come up randomly. Some of them have not worked well. I obviously focused on some of our better ones, but there's lists of things online. We had talked about doing something like this for a co-op class at one point, and we may still do that. But one of the ideas was that I came across looking up for this co-op class was calculating your likely period of survival in a zombie apocalypse. How long are you likely to survive? And it's based on where you live. It's based on your basic skills. It's based on, you know, are you disabled? Can you actually run? You know, are you your overall physical strength? Just all these, and so there's all these variables that go into it. And that's a great one. You know, that's a great one just to sit down with the kids, you know, depending on your kids' opinion, attitudes. But, you know, sometimes boys might be more into that. Then again, my daughter came up with a great, they just did a utopian class at co-op. So she'd probably, they studied utopia and dystopian stuff. So she'd probably love sitting down to do this and figuring out her chances of survival in the apocalypse. So you keep math in mind. When you're going into stuff, go into it, you know, if you're, I don't know, I think even most, what do we say, conventional homeschoolers who basically do public school at home, I think even most of them walk into a lot of activities once they've gotten into homeschooling looking for what they can learn out of it. Am I right? Do most of us go in and say, okay, this is what I can learn. This is what I can make a school experience. You know, if the kids really enjoyed this part, we may do a small unit on it, things like that. So most people, regardless, just do that with math. Go in with math. Say, where's the math in this? You know, where's the math in it? Well, we're going to have a birthday party. And I kind of like the tablecloth I have, and kids are murder on those. So let's go to the discount store, the party store, the dollar store, wherever you buy these things. But turn it into math beforehand. Measure the table. And go in and have the kids figure out, well, how far off. And they can estimate, too. You may have to make an extra trip to the store, depending on how this goes. But have them figure out and estimate. Well, if I stand next to the table, it hits just below my hip. So I'm just over 5 feet. So what's that? Is that 2 feet off the floor? So figure out how many inches I'm going to have of overhang, depending on the length of the tablecloth, things like that. Have them, if you're going to do it like the church dinner tablecloths, and you masking tape them under for everybody's sanity, have them estimate how many pieces of tape they'll need down each side. You know, some of this is, that's probably more of a younger kid. But, you know, your older kid, you say, well, we're going to go help set up for the ward dinner. How many people are in our ward? how many people usually come. If it's a Christmas one, if it's a Christmas party, more people usually come to that. People bring guests. How many tables do you think we'll need? How many people can we comfortably fit at a table? Things like that. Well, how much room do we need between them? All of that's math. You know, depending on your child's attitude about math, present it before or after. But, you know, if they're in an anti-math mode, teach them the concept. After they've done it and enjoyed it, point out that it was math. And one of the things I've come across in reading about this is that one of the biggest issues in math success is having what they call a growth mindset instead of a fixed mindset. Does that make sense? Has anybody heard that before? Your growth mindset, meaning you can learn, you can improve on this, and you can get better at it. Your fixed mindset can be either, I can't do this, or no, I already did this. I know it. Why would I want to do more? If I do more, maybe I'll fail. So going into it that way and deciding that that's what you want to give your child more than anything is that gift of knowing that they can do it. And doing your math in a more casual setting often sets that up. But just realizing how much math they're learning and teaching them how to apply it. That's kind of my point. So your radical unschooler might not consider this unschooling as much because I am intentional on it, like Chelsea talked about. But it really is interesting in some ways, and it's been pretty successful so far. So I think that's everything. Thank you, guys.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this record. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.